iHeart Podcasts.
I wanted to like be a good Mormon wife, but more than that, I wanted to be an actress. More than that, I wanted to be famous. And, you know, sitting in the hotel rooms and like being a call girl, I kind of got to be an actress.
Bond. Amy Bond. You know, there's a story about a young actress goes to Hollywood and she's hanging out at the counter of Schwab's drugstore getting a milkshake or something, and some guy comes up with his fingers in the shape of a goalpost and, you know, trying to figure out whether you're a movie star, and he discovers her and she goes on to fame and fortune. This trope has traveled as long as Hollywood has been Hollywood, but with Bond, Amy Bond, it was a different sort of journey. Yeah, she came to Hollywood. Yeah, she wanted to be an actress. But in mainstream movies, I don't know. But I do know. I'm your host, Eugene S. Robinson, and you're here for another edition of Ozzy Confidential. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fee, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there is no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections such as 100 Most Popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of Ozzy Confidential a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at confidential.robinhood.com.
So I grew up Mormon. My dad was Mormon until he died. My mom is like kind of Mormon. We were raised Mormon. And I think out of everyone in my family, I probably became the most militant Mormon of everyone. When I was like 13, I got really into it.
What does that mean to be like a militant Mormon?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, if you follow the rules, like by the letter of the law, it gets pretty intense. So like, you know, you go to church every day, and I went to a Bible study school before school, and I had 100% attendance, and you know, that was really important to me.
What's the deal with the magical underwear thing that you never take off your body?
That's a thing. Mm-hmm. And it's everybody has weird practices. Mm-hmm. Magical underwear is one of them. You know, for a long time growing up, I believed that I have this mole on my chest, and I believed, and this belief was like confirmed for me by multiple elders in my church, that God had put it on me to tell me where I should wear all my shirts above, because that was that if I wore a shirt below that mole, it was being immodest. And, you know, there's all these things that you tell yourself, or right, because God's trying to help you through life. Mm. I think a lot of people survive that way. My heart was always set on California. From the time I was young, I wanted to move to California. Mm. I wanted to be a Californian. You know, as like a young girl in Minnesota. Honestly, I think it was because of the Babysitter's Club. This is the series of books that was very popular when I was like 8 to 15 years old, that was about this group of women, girls, who had started a club called the Babysitter's Club. And one of the girls in the group was named Dawn. And Dawn was the quintessential California girl. She had blonde hair, she was a vegetarian, she cared about animals, and she was an artist. And I loved that idea of like being an artist.
How do you go from being a daily churchgoer at the age of 13, to being a young adult chasing their dreams.
I was traveling to finish school and then, you know, doing that backpacking thing.
Right, right.
And I was an au pair and really just, I felt like a bohemian for the first time in my life. I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, I met all these artists in Paris and I was 18 at the height of the Iraq War. And so there, a lot of the people I met were like squatters in like Paris mansions, and they would go out on the artists in war.
Right, right, right.
And I like met all these, I was an au pair, but I had a lot of spare time. So I got to go hang out with these people, and they really shaped the way I thought about spending time. Because up until then, I came from a military/very religious background, and time was a thing that you like did to do, to like put into work. And the idea that you like spent it creating papier-mâché caricatures of George Bush to go put in a float would probably be an insane thing to, or like a waste to those demographics. And suddenly I was immersed in this world of artists, and it felt very like deep and real to me, and like a good way to spend time rather than what many would consider a waste of it. But I was still very Mormon. And so I was balancing this like, go to church on Sundays and read the Bible every night before you go to bed with like, oh, but there's all these cool people who, you know, many of them didn't believe in God. And I thought that was just crazy, you know, like that's just wrong. And so I would pray for them, for their souls to be saved, because that's what you do. And I was able to like kind of live in both worlds really easily. And I think that's actually probably my superpower as a human, is I'm able to straddle different worlds. I had purchased this keyboard piano that, because one of the guys who was in this protest group played the keyboard, and he had started teaching me, but I wasn't very dedicated. But I liked how when I carried this keyboard around, people thought I was an artist. As soon as I put that keyboard under my arm, it was so easy to get hitchhike rides, because people are like, oh, she's an artist. You know, she just needs to get to her next gig. And I remember I had one, this one truck driver was like, I'll take you if you play me a song. And I was literally like, I can't. It must have been like 70 pounds, and I carried it the whole way to Italy.
Can't you play it now? You figure, nah, you can't. You understood? It was like a plot device to get her from a place of no adventure to a place of adventure. A physical place as well as a fantastical place that existed in her mind. And later, reality. Except she still can't play keyboard.
I went to Europe mainly because my parents were fine with me traveling as long as it was international. They're in the military, so their big thing was, you've got to travel the world. You've got to see how the rest of the world lives. And so it was okay to go to Europe, but then, you know, I really wanted to go to California. And so I went back home, made some money, and then I got on a bus and had one backpack. I didn't have the keyboard anymore. And I moved to California, and I had no plan.
So were they cool with this, or were they?
I wrote them a note. I ran away because I knew they wouldn't be cool with it.
Well, they wouldn't be cool with California?
No, yeah. They wouldn't be cool with California.
Why?
Because, I mean, my mom was the only woman, only person in her family to graduate from college. In her mind, going to California meant that I wasn't going to keep going to community college and get my degree. And, you know, for her, getting her degree was her pathway to freedom.
So, okay, so you say, you send them a note. I've run away. I'm in California.
I wrote them a note. I said, you're not going to like this, but I got on a bus, and I'm moving to California to chase my dreams to become an actress. I called my mom from Texas when the bus landed, and I called her and said, I'm okay. I'm safe. She was very unhappy. She just wanted me.
She said so, or you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I mean,
she was, what the fuck are you doing?
Right. Okay.
You know?
All right.
And that's kind of what I expected.
Yep.
You know.
But you just wanted to tell her you were okay.
I wanted her to know I was okay, that I loved her very much, had nothing to do with her, blah, blah, blah. But I needed to, like, go create my own path, right? I landed in Los Angeles, and like, I didn't have a room to rent. Mm-hmm. Like, I had not planned nothing.
Right.
Because in my mind, if I planned it, then it wasn't, like, the way an artist would do it.
Okay.
So
the bus station pulls in downtown LA, or where is
it? Yeah, bus station lands in downtown LA at like 3 o'clock in the morning. I walk out into the parking lot with my I think my backpack had actual sparkles on it. And there were two security guards standing in front of a parking lot next to the Greyhound bus station. There's like glass all over the cement. There's people sleeping on the parking lot, which I'd never seen before. I like freak out and I run back into the Greyhound bus station. And these two security guards, I see one of them pass the other a $5 bill and goes, "We had a bet on how long you'd be out there." And so I sat at this Greyhound bus station for like 3 hours. I told myself, well, if you get to Westwood, that's where there's UCLA, and then you can go find like a cork board with somebody who has housing for rent. Okay. And that's how I lived in Europe. You know, you just find a cork board in a coffee shop and then you get your next place to live. So I go look at all these cork boards in LA and everything is so expensive. And by the time I'm done looking at all these cork boards, like the sun is going down. So I'm like, well, I'm not going to find a place tonight. Like my one plan is backfired. And on the bus, I was so excited. I hadn't eaten in like 3 days. Like I had just been too excited to eat. And so I'm walking with like my luggage down the street. And I think I was probably crying and like walking down the street like, oh, shit, what am I going to do? And this car pulls up behind me and this guy jumps out and he goes, "Hey." And I'm like, "What?" You know, he's like, "You look like you need help." And so long story short, I end up living with this dude for like 3 weeks.
Was he old, young? How old? What was the story?
He was a graduate student at UCLA. Uh-huh. And I think he liked the idea of saving somebody. Uh-huh. So perfect. I needed some help. So it was great.
So there was no creepy ulterior sexual motive?
There was no creepy ulterior thing. Uh-huh. I made it very clear at this point. I was still a virgin. Yeah. I'm like, I'm a virgin. I'm very religious. I don't believe in premarital sex.
So you said this as you got in the car?
Well, when we got to his house, I was like, look, I don't want it to be weird.
Okay.
And he was cool.
Is it right?
I mean, this dude like drove me around. Uh-huh. He helped log me into his like student board so that I could look at all the housing that was on the internet, like on the UCLA specific internet. He helped me find a room. I found a room that was like $375 a month in Westwood. I shared it with like two other people and it was fine. So This guy really did like.
That's a solid.
Basically save me. Yeah.
That's solid. Yeah. And why'd you finally leave? Oh, I guess you found the room.
Yeah, I found the room. Right. He helped me find the room. Okay. Like, it was never, like, a long-term solution. Yeah, but he was like, I think you need help. I can help you.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, so you get your room.
I get my room. And Rick had driven me to Central Casting the first day after I stayed at his house. Oh. And I had heard that Central Casting was where everybody went when they were trying to be an actor. So I went there. I got my headshot taken. And lo and behold, they called me in like 5 minutes. And they were like, do you want to do Judge Judy? Sure. So I sat in the audience on Judge Judy. And then I sat in the audience of Judge Joe Brown. And then I sat in the audience. There was another judge. I forgot the third judge. But I worked the audience of judge shows for like 3 months.
And how much were they paying? They were paying you as an extra, right?
Pay you as an extra.
Was it like 75 a day? Or
it's like 100 a day.
100 a day, yeah.
Fine, good enough.
Yeah.
Like, my rent's $400,
yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, you can tell the folks back home, I'm on this show, I'm on that show.
That's right. So anyway, I'm on Judge Judy. I start going to all of these other casting calls, and I just can't nail, like, a real part, like a part that has speaking, right? And in order to get the SAG card, which is the holy grail for new actors in LA, you have to get, like, 3 speaking parts. And I remember going on this audition where there are these three girls sitting in.
Now, had you had acting classes before or not?
No.
Okay.
I had never taken an acting class. Also, by the way, I had tried out for my Hopkins High School, Minnetonka, Minnesota, high school musical. I couldn't even get a part in that. So, like, I'm by no means like an actress.
Right.
But I played an artist when I played that part.
With the keyboard.
When I was the keyboard, you know?
Right.
And I was like, if I just do it, then it will come true for me.
Right.
And to a certain extent, I think that's kind of a great way to live your life. But for me, I was overly confident. Like, I was very positive that I was going to be famous in like 3 months. And like, there was no doubt in my mind that was going to happen. So then that didn't happen in 3 months. And I had started to run out of money. And I meet these three girls at a sandal audition. It was like an audition to be in a sandal commercial.
You mean the resort or the actual footwear?
The foot, like a, okay. Like a sandal.
Okay, got it.
So I'm at this audition, and the three other girls who I'm sitting there with, and by the way, I had like taken the bus there, woken up at like 5 a.m. to get to this 10 a.m. audition, was still late, so I'd like run the last half mile. And I'm sitting there like sweaty and feeling just like the most disgusting person. And I'm looking at these three women, and they're like, you know, they're wearing like very expensive clothes. They have like keratin treatments in their hair. Their nails are well done. And they were talking about how they'd just gotten their toenails done for this audition. And I was like, oh, you got your toenails done for this audition? And they were like, yeah, that's what you do. You dress for the part you want. Like one of them like looked at me with this very like mean girl look. And she was like, you dress for the part you want. And I was like, oh, like I need to make like real money. I need to buy a car. I need to like buy pedicures when I go on auditions. Like I need to do all this shit. I didn't know that. So then I decided, well, the reason I'm not booking these why I'm not nailing them and getting the parts is because I just need more money in order to like play the part.
So you're in LA, scant funds, and you see that you're being outpaced by people who are spending a lot to look a lot better and actually act. So what do you do?
So I started nude modeling, and that was like step one. I was like,
how did you find the agency that got you to nude modeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's
you answered that.
Yeah, you answer an ad. The back of LA Weekly has everything you need. I answered two ads. I answered the back of an LA Weekly, and the two ads were, one was a woman who was basically like a pimp, right? And her ad said no sex. And I really liked the idea that I could come, that I could do this work, but go back to being religious.
Right.
Because I was still dating this Mormon guy at the same time.
Where was he living?
D.C.
Okay.
And I was just lying to him about everything.
Close to your parents?
Yeah, close to my parents.
Okay.
And
was his plan to eventually come out? Do you guys, or was it going to be a long
distance? We were like going to do the long distance thing, see how it worked, right? I mean, I think his plan was like, we'll get married and then you'll come live
back.
With me.
Okay.
Yeah. But I like had to make my dream come true, right? So I get hooked up with this woman who like does nude modeling shoots. And I get hooked up with another woman who she puts you up in a hotel room and then you do massages, right? So
that was a pimp woman.
That was my pimp woman.
Okay,
yeah.
Right,
I never learned her name. I always called her my girl.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But she was no nonsense. And I love that bitch because when you talked to her, you knew she was in a hurry. She had better shit to do than talk to you right now.
Yep.
So it was always super straightforward, to the point. Get in there. I'll call you when someone is here. I'll pick up the money at 10:30. And we did like a 50-50 split. So after like 2 weeks of like the nude modeling and the massages in the hotel room, which, by the way, it was usually actually massages.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like lonely dudes.
Yeah.
So it was actually like pretty cool.
Nude modeling thing was was there a product associated with that? So we're taking pictures of you for posters. We're taking pictures of you, or painters?
So there's a lot of photographers who do pictures that they think they can sell to a magazine.
A porno mag or any kind of magazine.
And in my mind at the time, nobody actually looks at porn. So I'm never going to get caught doing this because I didn't look at porn. The guy I was dating, I believed, didn't look at porn.
So you weren't draped over a nicely covered couch with grapes in your hand, you know?
Yeah.
The person's already in the hotel or you're in the
room? I'm in the hotel room.
And they come to you?
My girl calls me, hey, your name is Candy. Barry's coming up in 10 minutes.
Okay. So the guy comes in the room and what happens then?
He takes all his clothes off. She was very clear about the order of operations. So, you know, he has to put the money on the nightstand first. Then he can take his clothes off because a cop's never going to just, like, put money down.
Right.
So if he doesn't put money down, run for your life.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Okay, all right, all right. Did you ask her?
She even showed me like where the fire escape was.
Did you ever at any point ask her, like, why are we afraid of cops? It's just a massage.
No, that made sense.
Okay, you
yeah.
Okay.
I was like, I think this is illegal. Yeah. This is probably illegal.
Right.
But like that just made it more exciting.
Right.
I was here for the adventure.
So now these guys showed up for massages. Nobody tried to fuck you.
Nobody tried to fuck me.
Okay.
Like absolutely nobody. Wow. Yeah. It wasn't until I started doing house calls that changed.
So in call versus out call.
Yeah.
So somebody calls and says, I want a massage at my house.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, okay, well, it works out all right. You show up at the house. And then what happens then?
And then all bets are off. Like they'll offer more money for additional services. Mm-hmm. So my girl had a really smart, I think it's really smart. I mean, she's the only pimp I've ever worked with, you know, which is she would only send me to places where I was with somebody else. So it was like two girls that were ordered.
So,
right?
they asked for two girls.
Yeah.
Were the other girls willing to have sex or not?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you
almost always the other girl was willing to have sex and like down, like they were down to fuck because then they got more money. I was like, I think I can't go that far because God won't forgive me.
So you were sitting there as they're screwing, or you're like, it's okay, well, I did the massage, I'll just sit out here and wait for you guys? Or
no, I watched.
Yeah, okay, so you're there.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I mean, usually I would like fondle somebody, you know.
Yeah.
I would like massage somebody, fondle somebody, you know, like, hey, can you play with her tits? Sure, you know. That'll be an extra $200.
That was my question then. So how much money are you pulling in now from?
So between those two things, nude modeling was like $400 a day. And it was kind of like 6-hour days. A lot of standing around and being cold, which is, you know, kind of boring.
Yeah.
And then the like face to face was much more exciting because you're seeing this whole as a Mormon turned thrown into the sex world human. I was like, holy shit, you know,
right.
This is so insane.
Right.
This is like what movies are about. I didn't think this was real, you know. And so I would make a lot of cash between the hotel rooms and the massages and the calls. I would make, at the beginning, I only did hotel rooms. So I would make about $800 to $1,000 a day if I did like a full day sitting in a hotel room. The new modeling, like $400.
So she meets his photographer, Mike. Square guy, takes a lot of photos of her. But one day, Mike has got a problem. He's taking too many photos of her. And overexposure is an issue.
And he's like, you know, but what you could do is porn. And by the way, it pays a lot better. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, isn't that kind of what I'm already doing? So he introduces me to Jim South. I don't know who Jim South is. He's a legend. But at the time, I'm like, oh, hi, Jim, you know, small man in a cowboy hat. And he's in this office off of Van Nuys that's like dirty and like kind of dusty and kind of musty and gross. And so I don't think of him as this like, you know, epic legend who like starts all these careers. To me, porn was not a career. It was like a gateway to be able to do the thing I really wanted to do. And I'm still like undecided on like the porn thing. I'm like, well, I'll go meet Jim, but I don't know if I'm like gonna have sex with anyone in porn. Like that actually sounded so insane that it like made me really excited that it was an adventure. And so I meet Jim, and Jim tells me, well, you know, there's this guy named Ed Powers. Yeah. And I'm like, okay. And what I don't tell Jim and what I hadn't told Mike, because I thought that they wouldn't want to book me, is that I'm still a virgin. Like, I'm still a virgin, but I'm also a sex worker. So that's a weird mix, right? I don't tell them that, but I really liked the idea that Ed was nice. He was nice. He wasn't going to be aggressive. And there's another woman in the office at that time, and she turns around and she's like, Jim's the best. He will never put you in a compromised situation. So already this girl who's sitting in the office is like, I'm vouching for this guy. Like, he's the real deal. Like, he won't put you in a bad situation, which is what I really liked about my girl. She always made sure that we were safe. I got really lucky in that sense because I wasn't fucked with and I wasn't raped and I had a lot of fun being an adult entertainment actress.
Anyway, so you go over to its place and
he has this fancy house in Calabasas. Mm-hmm. Couldn't be nicer guy. Like, comes to the door.
So are you going with the understanding, like, oh, I'm just going to meet this guy? Or do you know?
I'm like, I'm going to do this.
Okay. All right.
And so my stomach is, like, churning. Mm-hmm. I, like, see the big mansion. I'm like, oh, shit. Like, this is happening.
And so what? Now you're, like, what, 21 or?
No, 20. I think I was still 19.
19. Okay.
Or it was, like, right after my 20th birthday.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I mean, 6 months later, I went to an adult entertainment event that I couldn't get into at a club because I wasn't 21 to drink.
All right, so you show up at house. He's got this mansion, and he's nice.
Super nice. He asked me a bunch of questions.
Like, what kind of questions?
Like, tell me about you. He loves the fact that I have a Mormon boyfriend, so we talked about that. Right. And then he could tell I was super nervous. So he's like really gentle, really nice, really kind. He was. Yeah. He's just like very, you just felt like what you were getting was very authentic.
Right.
And he was.
Right.
And then he paid me with a check and he had to be like, oh, what's your real name again?
Were you told him Candy at first? Or?
Well, Mike and I had decided that my name would be Wendy.
Ah.
So my porn name was Wendy James. Yeah.
Well, Wendy James, she's a singer as well.
Yeah, I now know that.
Right. Right.
But I didn't at the time. And so, you know, he said, you know, you've got that Peter Pan thing, that like forever youth thing going on, so you should be Wendy.
Okay.
But I was there for probably like an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Okay.
And I walk out with $1,500. So I'm like, fuck yeah. I can pay like 6 months rent with this thing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm on my way to my 50 grand.
Now, given that this was your first time that people have all this kind of, not necessarily romantic attachment, but significant attachment to their first time, how did this... How did this feel as a first time? Was it more or less than what you had expected before? I'm trying to get a fix on your frame of mind as you leave.
It really wasn't about the sex. It was about the money. So I like took myself to Starbucks, got a vanilla frappuccino, look at my phone, which by now I have a new phone, and there's like 5 missed voicemails from Jim that are like, Wendy, everybody wants to book you. And
on the basis of what?
I guess. Off the basis of the nude modeling pictures.
Ah, so
they see this fresh faced cherub looking girl. I've got that girl next door look.
Yeah.
And then it's just like off to the races. Like every place that I went on an audition for, there was a 2-sided piece of paper that said what you were willing to do.
Right.
Like, do you do like double penetration? Nope. Mm. Do you do anal? Nope. Mm. Do you do lesbian? Great. It was fun. Like I met so many fun people.
Yep.
Like it was fun and the people were really nice to me.
Yep. Do you have time left over to actually go on auditions for non-adult roles?
Yeah. Like I still, every Wednesday, I reserved Wednesday to be on the extra on Judge Judy, Judge Showbrown. And I kept that because it was my perfect cover. When I went to church on Sundays, people would be like, oh, I saw you on Judge Judy. Perfect. You can see I am a struggling actress.
Right.
Exactly how I want you to think.
Right.
You know,
right.
My boyfriend. Oh, I saw you on Judge Judy. Oh, perfect. Yeah. I was like living a double life.
Right.
Like I was trying my best to live a double life.
Right.
The dude in DC, 4 months into the porn, I'm like, look, this is what's going on. I'm probably like, I'm really enjoying this life. I don't think I'm actually Mormon anymore. And for him, he like ran the other direction. Which, like, this is antithetical to everything he believes in.
So, hold on. When you said, you told him you don't think you're into Mormon, did you tell him about the movies or no?
I casually mentioned that maybe I had done adult entertainment.
See?
Yeah, I did not say porn. I did not say sex work.
Oh.
I said adult entertainment.
Did he get angry or was he just upset?
Oh, I mean, he was heartbroken. Yeah. And, like, what would you feel if you'd believed this person you were in love with has been betraying you and lying to you for the past, like, 4 months?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's shitty.
Yeah.
Because on the side, we were talking about how we were going to get married.
The whole time.
That's shitty.
Yeah,
it's a shitty way to treat someone.
Yeah.
But also, I was over the church. Like, by that point, I was like, you know, I don't think this is real anymore. So then I'm living my best life for a good, like, 4 months. Call girling. I'm going on cool gigs. I wasn't really auditioning for real movies anymore because that was what I was going to do after I'd made all my cash. Right. And going on set, suddenly I'm like known as like a rising starlet in the porn world, which is crazy, you know?
Now, if this were some other podcast and some other interview, this is the point at which the interviewer gets this tone in their voice where mm-hmm. they indicate that they feel fucking sorry for you, or that there's somehow, that this is somehow a deviation from the normal that is somehow mm-hmm. sad. But it doesn't sound at all to me like that jibes with the reality that you're spelling out. No. Most people would say they imagine life working as a porn star and a call girl would be miserable, but it doesn't sound like that was your experience.
It was fantastic. Yeah. And for me, it was quite autonomous. Mm-hmm. For the first time in my life, I'm making my own money, like real fucking money. Like, this is not like Nordstrom commission money where you got like $1,000 a month. Like, this is like you're bringing in like $2,000 a day. Cool. And if you're disciplined enough to like put it away, that adds up really fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, it got to the point where I couldn't like go to the bank and look at the teller anymore because they'd look at me suspiciously.
Okay, but what do you say to those people then who say like, this is degrading and that this is not something that should, and I don't want to minimize that argument as well. I mean,
for me, I didn't know enough to like think of myself as like an empowered sex worker, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think if you talk to, there's a famous author named Antonia Crane, mm-hmm. and there are all these, you know, Stormy Daniels is a great example. Right. I mean, she's an American hero, one, but also she's a woman who is like, she is a sex worker and she is loud and proud about being a sex worker. I was never that. So I want to be clear about that. I was never loud and proud. I was always lying about it. There was never a time when I was fully honest with anyone about the fact that I was doing it because I clearly like felt some shame about it. Even after I stopped being Mormon. So I didn't think of myself that way, but it was the first time in my life that I thought of myself as the owner of my own body. And like, you know, nobody told me what they were going to do to my body. They always asked on a piece of paper, where are your boundaries? And that's what I loved about porn, is everything was so upfront. Yes, this is a transaction. Yes, this is for money. Yes, we will be trading sex. But I would need to know where your boundaries are. And porn is highly regulated. So like, you do your HIV test every 30 days and you show your piece of paper to the other actor. And if they don't have their paper, you are not having sex with them. And growing up religious, I never thought of my body really as mine. I thought of it as a tool to like have children with and something really to be ashamed of. And so then I'm like immersed in this world that's telling me not only is your body yours, but also you can like very utilitarianly like make money with it. And also it's something to be celebrated, so much so that we're going to sell this, you know, like, and so that was all like very new and exciting for me. And so now I'm making really good cash, but I have to make it seem like I'm still a starving artist. Right. So I'm like acting in my real life at being a starving artist, which I'm not anymore. I have like a ton of cash that I'm just like putting into the bank. And I'd like,
so you're actually being good about that, because you're not.
I was great about that.
Drug use? No. Yes.
I didn't get into drugs mm-hmm. until I met a dude. Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of where the fun ended.
Now, if you paid attention at all, the narrative is usually things start going wrong and then you get into porn. In actual fact, porn was a high point, and they didn't start going wrong for Amy until after she left porn. The bad boyfriend, the drugs, hashtag it all.
So I meet this dude, and I meet him as a call girl. He's like one of my clients, and I fall in love with him. And maybe more than falling in love with him, I fall in love with his meth. As soon as I move in with him, it's abusive. He's in the middle of a divorce. And so I get in my car, I drive away. I'm like, fuck you, I'm not moving in after all. And he does the thing, right? I'm so sorry, baby, it will never happen again. Oh my God, I can't believe that happened. It's because of my divorce and all of the stress of my divorce. I go back that night. I go back over and over and over. We do meth all night long. We fight all the time. It's kind of exciting.
So now, what are folks knowing back home at this point? Anything?
My sister actually moved to Simi Valley. She moves in with me and Manny, this guy who was abusive.
Why did she do this?
Because I won't leave him. Like, I keep not leaving him.
So she moves out specifically to help you leave him? Or yeah. Just to, okay.
Yeah. Right. And she hatches a plan. We're going to run away in the middle of the night. She finds a place for us to live, like, secretly. And then in the middle of the night, she has this bag packed for us, and we run away.
Like, he's sleeping or he's not there?
He's sleeping, but he's not sleeping that hard because 5 minutes after we walk out the front door and start walking down the street, I can hear his car. And he had a Lincoln with, like, a really high cylinder engine.
Yeah.
And so when he starts his car, I know what that sounds like. And I'm like, oh, fuck. That's Manny. We run down the street. We hide in the bushes of this graveyard that's like behind the house that we were living in. And it's like straight out of like a movie. Like we're like hiding from this guy. And he's texting me every 2 minutes. You piece of shit. What are you doing? I'm going to find you. I'm going to kill you. Yeah. We try to get a restraining order. It's not enough that he's made these threats over text message. And she literally saved my life. And we go back to being waitresses together. And I live with my sister. And the dude slowly fades away.
Manny stops trying to find you.
Exactly. Okay. And then I rebuild my life. So I went to community college. It took me like 6 years to finish a 2-year degree. Right. Like get my AA took right. 6 years. Right. And I transferred to Berkeley. Okay. So I got into UC Berkeley.
So your grades are good enough to get into Berkeley?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. When did you meet your husband?
I met my husband after I graduated from Berkeley.
Okay.
I was in Portland, Oregon, working as an LSAT tutor.
Right.
So I was tutoring LSAT. I was a personal trainer on the side. And I was just like taking that gap year between undergrad and law school. You know, I didn't want to meet anyone before law school because I wanted to be able to focus. But I meet Keith and it was just like love at first sight situation. And it wasn't even a choice. It was like, this is the person I'm going to spend my life with. And, you know, right now I run two pole dance studios and I'm an attorney. So, you know, on the weekends I do like credible fear interviews for immigrants who are trying to come to the United States.
So is immigration law your specialty?
Immigration law is one that I've recently become interested in because of the human rights violations that the United States government is involved in terms of how we're separating children from their families. And we actually don't have a process for reuniting those children. And there's just an article about how, you know, all these parents were sent back to Guatemala. Their children are still here living in foster families. That's crazy. So immigration law is not my specialty, but I've gotten really into it in the past year. So I run businesses by day and I, you know, create pole dance art, which is kind of weird and underground to most people, even though it's what I see every day. And do law on the weekends, and that's kind of how I like to live my life.
Okay, so you're not stuck in some corporate law thing where you got billable hours to deal with, or
no, okay. Yeah, good for you. No, yeah. I mean, I meet a lot of those people. Yeah. I know a lot of those people. Yeah. It's really shaped the way that I think about my body now, which is just a tool, and. You know, my creative work as a pole dancer and a competitive pole dancer now is really around like creating art with my body. And I'm not sure I would have ever not had the shame to be able to do that if it hadn't been for becoming a sex worker so long ago. And I wish that I had had a place that was so full of like female empowerment and like women celebrating other women and, you know, moving to LA and having my formative growing up years be like women competing with other women for roles or whatever. And only finding that real like support in the adult entertainment industry. And then having that taken from me because I made a poor relationship decision. Like, I wish I had had spaces like this that were safe spaces to express sexuality. And so that's why they're so important to me and why I create them today. And so I want to keep doing this.
If you could tell your younger self something, what would you tell your younger self?
I think it would be the opposite of what you would expect, which is For the 10 years after I got out of porn, I didn't talk about my story. I told myself that it was something to be ashamed of, and the world around me told me the same thing too, right? Like when I was a waitress, men would recognize me, and then they would use the fact that they recognized me against me. They'd like wait for me in the parking lot and be like, I know your secret, you know, if we don't fuck, whatever, da da da. And it was to the point where I had somebody escort me to my car. And I wish that I had just owned my story earlier. Like, I wish that, you know, I'm really proud of looking back, I'm really proud of how like resourceful I was. You know, I arrived in Los Angeles with nothing, and then I found Rick. And, you know, and then I just let myself be open to the universe in a way that the universe actually really did take care of me. And I'm a really big believer in like having a life that's not so stringently planned, that like you let the world happen to you versus like trying to control everything. And I wish I hadn't spent so much time feeling shame for something that's actually like a really exciting, cool thing looking back on it now. And it wasn't until about 5 years ago when I'm living here, so a decade in San Francisco, so about a decade after all of this story is over, right, that my mom texts me and she says, hey, Amy, who's Wendy James? And I'm like, oh, bitch, you're going to need to sit down for this one.
If your adventure high point hits when you're 20 and you're 35 now, looking back on greatness, can you square yourself going forward with a life that you expect won't be nearly as adventurous? I don't know. But Bond, Amy Bond, I guess she's geared to find out. And so are we. Ozzy Confidential. Ozzy Confidential is produced by who else? Me, Eugene S. Robinson, executive produced by Rob Kulos, and mixed and engineered by Nick Johnson. And for more Ozzy Confidential, go to ozy.com/confidential. Oh, sure.